a place where, if it meets favorable conditions, it can germinate to create another dandelion. Even if you hate this common weed, you've got to respect its tenacious spirit. Dandelions are native to 6 continents and are found throughout the world except in the tropics. Their impressive roots, which can be up to 1 foot long, allow them to thrive in inhospitable environments like big cities where most flowers and weeds can't survive. Cut off a dandelion at the surface and the root will grow another plant. But dandelions aren't just annoying weeds. They've been used throughout history in a variety of ways. Dandelion leaves have been eaten as salad greens and dried to make dandelion tea, and dandelion flowers have been used to make wine and schnapps. In addition, the milky juice of one kind of dandelion has been used to make a natural rubber. This moment of science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the American Society of Plant Biologists. Today's program was prepared by Barbara Bowles, with help from Charles Heiser and Lewis Johnson in biology. I'm Don Glass.
It's 2:41. Your gift of $25 today to WILL can make a big difference. We will take your gift and we'll add it in with the gifts from your neighbors and your friends, and we'll create a WILL member match fund. And then we'll use the money in that match fund during our October pledge drive to encourage other listeners to support WILL. So go to willpledge.org today and make your gift. In sports, University of New Mexico administrators have opened an investigation into a fight where head football coach Mike Loxley struck an assistant. The first-year coach could be suspended or fired as a result. The investigation will be directed by the university's Human Resources Division. It comes after athletics director Paul Krebs said on Monday that Loxley was issued verbal and written reprimands for his role in a September 20th dispute. Receivers coach J.B. Gerald told police that Loxley struck him, splitting his lip. At his weekly news conference yesterday, Loxley said he accepted responsibility for his actions and should have handled the situation better. He said he apologized to Gerald, the coaches, and the team. Under the university's policies on campus violence, employees face progressive discipline for violent behavior. The policies say that some violations may be of such serious nature that immediate suspension or discharge may be appropriate. Loxley is the former offensive coordinator for the Illinois football team. He's had a turbulent start at New Mexico. He's denied wrongdoing in an Equal Opportunity Commission complaint alleging sexual harassment and age discrimination and retaliation. A former football administrative assistant filed that complaint last spring, claiming that she was improperly fired because Loxley wanted a, quote, younger gal, end of quote, who would entice recruits. Home field advantage in the National League playoffs may be out of reach of the Cardinals. The Cards trail Philadelphia by a game for the NL's second-best record and could play the Dodgers in the first round if Colorado wins the wild card. The Cardinals play in Cincinnati again tonight. Cubs and White Sox have doubleheaders today. The Cubs hosting Pittsburgh in a day-night doubleheader. And at the end of 6 innings, Pittsburgh is leading in that first game 4-2-0 over the Cubs. 4-0, the end of 6 innings. The White Sox will play a pair in Cleveland. St. Louis will open its own Sports Hall of Fame in November at the Scott Trade Center, where the Blues play. The first inductees will be baseball great Stan Musial and Olympic gold medalist Jackie Joyner-Kersee. The hall will also display artifacts, including autographed baseballs from the 1934 Cardinal Gashouse Gang. And that's a look at sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Well, by the end of this week, we will officially know, for sure, if Chicago will host the 2016 Summer Olympics. A debate has boiled about whether the Games would actually create jobs, improve neighborhoods, and fuel tourism, or be an expensive flop that draws attention away from the city's other needs. At the center of the debate, Mayor Richard Daley. And he could be the most nervous Chicagoan right now, as Sam Hudzik reports.
Flashback to April 2007, a Washington, D.C. hotel conference room.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, I am proud, very proud to announce.
The U.S. Olympic Committee chairman at the time, Peter Ueberroth, was about to reveal whether the panel had picked Chicago or Los Angeles.
The United States applicant city for the 2016 Olympic and Paralympic Games is Chicago.
Yeah. I was very, very nervous. That's why I jumped right out of the seat. I was like a little kid watching the Olympics.
The often disheveled and occasionally moody Richard Daley looked like he just couldn't stop smiling. And so began in earnest the adventure that wraps up this week. Over the past 2.5 years, Daley's fought through questions and complaints from community activists, a handful of publicly skeptical aldermen, reporters, and Chicagoans like Judith Rogers.
I am so damn sick of hearing about this Olympics.
Rogers and others attending a city budget hearing last month at the South Shore Cultural Center mocked the mayor's efforts to his face.
It's only for bragging rights. If you can raise that kind of money to put on an Olympics, you can take that money and you can put more police on the street.
Daley sat silently through Rogers' speech, but at press conferences, he has repeatedly denied the Olympics has anything to do with his own image.
This is not about Richard J. Daley's or Richard M. Daley's legacy. This is about the city of Chicago. The Olympic and Paralympic is bigger than me.
Daley last week said that even if Chicago doesn't get the games, it'll still be better off after getting all that international exposure. But let's face it, if that happens, he's going to take it hard, a missed chance at big history.
The Olympics is more of a kind of a like a spaceship that lands in Chicago. If it doesn't land, then it just comes close. It's less of a story.
Russell Lewis is the chief historian at the Chicago History Museum.
I think people will move on fairly quickly. I think Daley will be disappointed. But if we get it, that's when really it's going to be, I think, a little difficult for him.
That might sound backward, but Lewis argues that getting the Olympics would present a big risk for the mayor.
You sell something like the Olympics with all of these benefits that are going to, come our way, but there's no way to really predict if that's going to happen.
So, Lewis says, if Daley gets what he wants, it means he'll have to make good on all the promises he made. And if he can't, if everything Olympic detractors say could go wrong does, from cronyism and scandal to gentrification and cost overruns,
people will look at those problems and then work back retrospectively and say, see, here's a pattern.
A pattern of issues that could taint a legacy. Think about the problems with Millennium Park, Block 37, the O'Hare Airport expansion. All at times embarrassments for the mayor. Embarrassments Daley may be able to move past if he can pull off a successful Olympics.
Certainly, this is all about legacy building. It's all about cementing Richard M. Daley's place in Chicago history.
Chicago historian and author Richard Lindbergh.
Just as the effort to win the 1893 World's Fair was all about Carter Harrison's legacy once he was reelected. And the same was true of Anton Cermak in 1933 when that World's Fair came to town.
Daley's defenders on the city council argue his legacy will be more about education reform and city beautification than the Olympics. Nobody I talk to, from historians to aldermen, thinks the mayor's got much riding politically on Olympic success. With no viable opponents yet emerging for the 2011 election, history may be the only thing right now that can make Richard Daley nervous. I'm Sam Hudzik.
Joseph White's announcement last week that he would resign as president of the University of Illinois is not the only time a president at the university was forced out of office. 56 years ago, the Board of Trustees pressured George Stoddard into stepping down as president after a 7-year tenure marked by controversy. AM 580's Jeff Bossert spoke with Professor Emeritus of History Wynton Solberg on both the good and the bad of Stoddard's tenure.
Professor Solberg has written about the University of Illinois during the turn of the last century, but he's also made a study of the controversy that shook the university half a century ago. Child psychologist George Stoddard came to the U of I from New York in 1946, where he'd served as state commissioner of education. Solberg says Stoddard was seen as a large upgrade from his predecessor, Arthur Willard, who was seen as having made poor choices as an administrator.
Sauter's a very well-recognized figure. He's on the UNESCO, a cultural United Nations education, social, and cultural organization. He was on President Truman's commission of education that went out to set up the educational system in Japan. He is a very prominent person, and he comes here with ringing in his mind the statement made by the president of the University of Minnesota that the University of Illinois is a sleeping giant that's about to waken up.
Solberg also says Stoddard was a faculty man with 17 years teaching experience at the University of Iowa. But Solberg says he also moved too fast to expand academics once at the U of I.
He rejuvenated the College of Business, College of Commerce, which included the Department of Economics. That thing blew up in his face. Stoddard was responsible for creating at Illinois one of the best economics departments in the country at that time, particularly among state universities. Most of those people left when Stoddard was fired.
Another controversy that would dominate Stoddard's time at the U of I was that of a purported cure for cancer. Solberg says that helped seal the president's fate with the Board of Trustees.
There was a vice president of the medical school by the name of Dr. Ivey, Andrew S. Ivey. Ivey presumably had written a lot of research papers. They're jointly authored. He's a man with a big ego, as many types are. He got involved with the Durovic brothers, some emigres from Yugoslavia, who had a horse serum type of medicine called crobiazin that they peddled as a cure for cancer. And Ivy, I think, tied into that. And so this was a very nasty business, too. Stoddard let it run for a long time, and he finally said, there will be no more of that. I put a halt to these experiments and so forth. I think he moved much too late, not much too quickly. But that movement had got caught up with Illinois and particularly West Side Chicago politics.
Solberg says Stoddard was also criticized by trustees for frequently leaving town on business trips.
And at one point, the board had to say, you've got to stay home more and mind the store. His response was, well, I work very hard. I get more done in a day than most people do because I put in more hours. But a president who is so insensitive that a board has to remind him to stay home and watch the shop more is not very attentive to his own best interests. The point I'm making then is Stoddard had aroused so much antagonism for so long that many of the board were waiting for him. I think he antagonized much if not most of his board, maybe not all of it. Stoddard is essentially a liberal in politics, and he's dealing with a board of trustees who's very, very conservative.
Solberg says the animosity against Stoddard grew and led to a 6-3 no-confidence vote by trustees meeting behind closed doors in 1953. In an interview with former trustees president Park Livingston, Solberg says he asked him why the board didn't conduct formal hearings to judge whether Stoddard was fit to go on.
He said, we couldn't do it that way. If you're going to kill an enemy, you've got to do it very swiftly. I'm not sure that was his language, but that's the basic thought. So they had this midnight meeting on the night of July 24th. Most of the professors are either out of town or not involved with the university closely. The students are not on the campus. Most of the members of the Board of Trustees didn't know what the agenda on the meeting was. I think they met at 8:30 as a committee of the whole and then went into an executive session. Just before midnight, they called Stoddard in and told him that he had been asked to go. They wanted his letter of resignation. Park Livingston once told me, he said, that he and Stoddard were out on a boat. And Livingston asked Stoddard what he craved most, what he would like most in the world. And Stoddard thought for a while and said, to be liked by other people. And Livingston thought that was such a feminine, cowardly response. He just had contempt for it. I cite this merely to suggest the deep antagonism between two men who had at one time worked together in a common enterprise.
The minutes for that midnight meeting say absolutely nothing about what transpired. Professor Solberg says there are rumors that the original no-confidence motion was made by one-time U of I trustee and football hero Harold Red Grange, but says Park Livingston told him that no motion was made at all. Solberg says Stoddard's forced resignation caused a deep scar on campus, particularly among faculty who had recently come to teach in Urbana. And Solberg says the interim president, U of I Comptroller Lloyd Morey, worked well with the trustees but alienated some faculty. As for Stoddard, he went on to spend 12 years at New York University, four of them as chancellor. And Solberg says, judging from a 1961 interview he conducted with Stoddard, the former U of I president had moved on and didn't hold a grudge against the trustees. George Stoddard died in 1981 at the age of 84. He was not only a noted educator, but the author of over a dozen books, including Krebiosyn, The Great Cancer Mystery, in which he described his ouster from the U of I. I'm Jeff Bossert, AM 580 News.
Interactive television is a marketing term, perhaps a marketing dream, that has been around for years. The idea is that if couch potatoes see something they like in a commercial, they can click on the remote and buy it. Well, that idea is becoming more of a reality. And the first large-scale rollout is from the New York Cable Company. Next week, it'll offer an early version of the service to its digital subscribers, and we hear more from Jesse Baker.
It was supposed to be the Jennifer Aniston effect, back when Friends was still on NBC.
Well, excuse me, my fashion-impaired friends. I am here to tell you that hats are back.
Aniston was the trend-setting, haircut-inspiring Rachel Green. The idea was that viewers could see her wearing a sweater or a skirt they liked and use their TV remotes to buy it. The idea never quite materialized before Friends went off the air, but the promise of interactive TV still lingers. The media giant Cablevision next week is rolling out to millions of its cable subscribers interactive commercials.
With a simple push of the select button, get coupons, information, and even free samples delivered right to your door. Optimum Select, coming this fall from IOTV.
We made a conscious effort to not oversell and not overpromise what Optimum Select can do.
That's Cablevision's Gemma Toner.
And as part of our marketing strategy, we actually are truly delivering the products so that when they press select, we're not telling them they can get a coupon. We are actually delivering that coupon to them.
Just to be clear, you can't actually buy products off these commercials just yet. You can ask for more information or request a free sample of things like Benjamin Moore paint. It is one of a handful of national brands airing interactive ads across 25 cable networks in the greater New York area. Sam Craig is a marketing professor at New York University, and he thinks these types of ads would most appeal to a certain kind of viewer.
Someone that you'd categorize as an impulsive person. Someone that's very deliberate, that takes time to make decisions, is not going to respond to something on the television.
And Craig says, imagine how much product QVC could push if shoppers could just hit a purchase button on their remotes.
J140434 is the item number. Stay on the line for that one, and we're going to go right into the earrings that you could wear with it.
Interactive marketing seems destined to appeal to the infomercial clientele. You know, the same people who would order a Snuggie for their dog?
So how do you keep your dog